a terrific morning in terms of introducing the extent of the problem, exposures. You saw with Dr. Haley's work, so much research and information showing the problems in terms of clinical problems, specifically with autism spectrum disorders and Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative diseases. And now we want to move into for the final session of the morning, which will then be followed by a panel with all three speakers, will be the clinical picture of mercury toxicity. And the presenter will be Dr. Stephanie Cave. And Dr. Cave is an expert in this field. She received her MD from the Louisiana State University Medical School in 83, so over 20 years ago. She's on the clinical faculty of LSU Medical School. She has an integrative medicine practice in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Dr. Cave has been very involved in the field of heavy metal toxicity, specifically mercury and autism spectrum disorders. In her practice, she treats thousands of children in the spectrum with great success. And I actually met Stephanie through the work that I do in the same field. She's written a book that many of you may want to get and have your patients get, called What Your Doctor May Not Tell You About Children's Vaccinations. And I have my patients get that when we have discussions about vaccinations. She's actually testified before governmental reform committees in terms of mercury and is doing an exceptional amount of work in this field. And she's an expert clinician. So she's going to give you the clinical picture of mercury toxicity.
Okay, we've now had an idea of sources for mercury, and I have some of that. I'll kind of go through that quickly. We've seen the biochemical mechanisms, so we'll go into more of a clinical picture, which will be fun. Generally, mercury has been a metal that we've seen in so many areas of our practice. We see a lot of heavy metal toxicity, but probably mercury is the worst that I see, simply also because I see so many of these children. And it's not just mercury that we have in those shots. We do have mercury and aluminum in the vaccines, and it has not all been taken out. A lot of the physicians now are being sold preservative-free single-dose vaccines, and you need to know that some of these do still contain thimerosal. It's used as a sterilizer. So even if they don't add it back as a preservative, it can still be in the vaccine as a sterilizer. And what does a physician think when he's being detailed a preservative-free vaccine? He's thinking mercury-free. So he's telling the parent of the child that the mercury-free vaccine is available, and the parent believes this, it's given to the child, and there may be less thimerosal, but still, how much poison is okay for any individual biochemical unit? So generally, we'll talk about the clinical picture that we see, and when you have something like mercury that can affect protein so basically, you're going to see problems in every system of the body. We've already talked about Minamata. Iraq had exposures through grain, and we saw very similar symptoms in those patients. We've had a discussion of dental mercury toxicity, and we'll go a little bit more into that. Acridinia was something that was seen in children, and this is pink disease. And it took us 50 years to decide that this was linked to mercury, but it was calomel teething powder that was put on the gums of these children. And it was not even realized until mid-20th century that this was caused by mercury. But the children, and we'll show you some pictures, the children looked exactly as these autistic children do today. And of course, we'll talk about autism, and I'll give you some case histories. So mercury is what I'll discuss. All of the others are very important, but this is number one in my clinic. And the sources we've gone through, dental amalgams, food sources, medications, vaccines, industrial, I won't belabor that. We've also talked about the three types, the elemental, inorganic, and organic. And this is just to show that the different types of mercury as they enter the brain, mercury vapor comes in, goes to mercuric mercury. Thimerosal as ethyl mercury comes into the brain, becomes mercuric mercury. And the methyl mercury may also. And this is what stays with the 20-year half-life in the brain, very difficult to remove. So as far as the physiological effects of mercury, it does actually alter the structure and function of enzymes and other proteins by binding to sulfhydryl groups. It increases the permeability of the tubule epithelium in the kidney, leading to protein loss. And these can be any enzymes. They can be structural proteins. They're both inhibited when bound to mercury. So you really get a loss of enzyme function and a loss of your structural integrity of these proteins. And this is just to illustrate your protein with your sulfhydryl groups and the mercury. And this is how you bind it. And this is one of Boyd Haley's slides that I like. And he just talked about neuronal tubulin. It's the most abundant brain protein, and it's especially vulnerable to mercury, and he has shown that. So we're looking at many bodily systems, neurological, immunological, gastrointestinal, renal, liver, cardiovascular, and we get free radical pathology in all systems. With inorganic mercury, less than 10% is absorbed from the intestine. You get dermal absorption. It really doesn't cross blood-brain barrier to the extent that something like vapor or your organic mercury would. It's used as a topical antiseptic, cathartic, and antisyphilitic agent in past years. It has a metallic taste in the mouth. It causes nausea, vomiting, bloody diarrhea, abdominal pain, cardiovascular collapse, dehydration, intestinal fibrosis, stenosis, tubular necrosis, uremia, and death. These are all possibilities for inorganic. With the organic mercury, methylmercury comes from seafood primarily, ethylmercury primarily from the vaccines. The major route of excretion is through bile into feces, and when you're giving vaccines to a one-day-old child, there's very little bile production, so it can't get out into feces as we normally think it should, and the blood-brain barrier is very weak, so it can go in and go up into, cross the blood-brain barrier. The biological half-life is about 70 days. The mercury in hair is 90% methylmercury. Daily excretion of methylmercury is about 1% of body burden. And methylmercury is excreted via bile and stool, we said, and neonates, of course, excrete more slowly. In the central nervous system and kidney, we find key targets for mercury. With acute poisoning, we'll see it in the respiratory and GI tract, and our secondary targets are cardiovascular and immune. With mercury vapor, we can see psychological changes, insomnia, loss of appetite, weight loss, shyness, emotional instability, headache, memory loss, and irritability. We can also see colitis, pneumonitis, bronchiolitis, pulmonary edema, stomatitis, down to death. Mercury toxicity is difficult at times to diagnose. It depends on the age, the type of mercury involved, the duration of exposure, the dose of exposure, the route of exposure. Genetic predisposition is very important, and we've realized this with the autistic children. We're actually not saying, with all of the work that we've done, that genetics are not involved. Certainly there's a genetic setup with these children. Probably many genes are involved, but it does take an environmental trigger. And the biochemical condition of the patient at the time of the exposure, and this is very important. There's a long latent period between exposure and the onset of symptoms and the diverse manifestations. And if you have a metal that affects enzymes and proteins, you're going to have diverse manifestations. Most seem to develop movement disorders, jerking, repetitive movements, tremors, clumsiness. Mood disorders we see often, isolation, anxiety, aggression, depression, violence, and obsessive-compulsive tendencies. I was watching my grandson walk only on the black squares the other day. Unusual behavior, stereotypic sniffing, hyperactivity, agitation, eating disorders, masturbation, staring spells, unprovoked crying. And what they saw in Minamata was ataxia, paresthesias, malaise, blurred vision, impaired hearing, taste, and smell primarily. And of course, Boyd Haley's talked about his work that he's done with Alzheimer's, looking like it's linked to mercury and aluminum. So we're kind of sitting in the middle of these generations. We have an epidemic of autism because we've injected ethyl mercury and aluminum into these little children, and we're looking at 1 out of 5 over 80 years of age with Alzheimer's, possibly with the same metal toxicity. So mercury is cytotoxic. It penetrates the blood-brain barrier. It generates reactive oxygen species. It's neurotoxic, immunotoxic. It inhibits T and B cells. It induces autoimmune antibodies. It's a reproductive toxin. It damages sperm, DNA. It gives menstrual disturbances, causes hypothyroidism in the fetus, causes infertility, and causes birth defects. It can damage endothelial cells and vessels in the cardiovascular system. It can cause damage to contractile proteins, increases blood pressure, produces tachycardia, decreases oxyhemoglobin level, and increases the risk of myocardial infarction. In the gastrointestinal system, we can see destruction of stomach and intestinal epithelial cells. It can damage the stomach lining and encourages the growth of Helicobacter pylori. And we're seeing many, many cases of Helicobacter in recent years. In the immune system, it interferes with cytokines. It disables early control of viruses. Methylmercury inhibits macrophages and promotes candida infections. In the endocrine system, we see hypothyroidism, autoimmune thyroiditis. It can lower testosterone levels. It has estrogenic effects. It affects neurotransmitters, dopamine, serotonin, norepinephrine, and pituitary dysfunction. With mercury toxicity, we also see mitochondrial release of calcium. It impairs cysteine regulation, inhibits glucose transport, damages sulfur oxidation processes, and reduces glutathione. And this is, again, one of Dr. Haley's slides. And it just shows that the greatest amount of mercury that we get into the systems comes through dental amalgams. This is air and water and food, and this is dental amalgam. In the dental mercury amalgams, the average filling has 0.5 grams of mercury. 50% is vaporized after 5 years, 80% by 20 years, and there are dissimilar metals which can cause a galvanic action with much higher release of mercury vapor from the fillings. I see often some of my very sick people and my chronically ill people, chronic fatiguers, with mercury amalgam fillings and gold crowns in very close proximity. And it's almost getting to be the norm in my practice. When I see someone come in with a cancer, I go directly to the mouth and I know I'm going to see gold crowns and silver fillings, especially in the younger cancer patients, in the 40-year-olds. As far as dental mercury is in prenatal and postnatal periods, mercury does cross the placenta. It appears in amniotic fluid. Dental mercury is the main source in breast milk, and mercury is stored in milk in the fetus in much higher concentrations, as we've seen from Lynn's work. Pizzicini found a significant correlation between mercury and saliva and the number of amalgam fillings in both men and women. And an Italian study of 122 workers exposed to mercury vapor and 196 controls showed statistically significant decline in motor performance. It was a cross-section study in Scotland. 180 dentists were compared with 180 academics at Scottish universities. Kidney disease was found to be 10 times more common among the dentists, 6.5%, than in the controls. Meta-analysis of 44 epidemiological studies of populations that are occupationally exposed to mercury vapor. In a population of 686 exposed persons and 579 controls, in 9 neuropsychological performance parameters, there were statistically significant differences between exposed persons and controls. Since 1997, 3 new health risks have emerged that have been attributed to mercury from amalgam: retinal function, testicular function, and thyroid function problems. It was a Swiss dentist who followed 75 of 90 patients who had amalgam removal. All had psychoneurological symptoms or muscular or joint pain. 68% felt better when removing the amalgams. 12%, much better, 12% better, 9% slightly better, 7% unchanged, and only 1% worsened. With the elimination of amalgam fillings, we will confer gains in three areas. Side effects from patients' mercury exposure will decline. Occupational exposure to mercury will cease in the dental office, and one of the largest sources of mercury in the environment can be eliminated. Now we'll go back to pink disease. If we go back and look at some of the discussions of the symptoms of the children from pink disease, they're very similar to what we see with the autistic children. There was apathy, lost play, sound and light sensitivity, aversion to touch, head banging, insomnia, repetitive rocking, repetitive hand rubbing, poor muscle tone, seizures, and infections. And this is seen both in autism and pink disease. And these are children. This is a child with pink disease, a typical one, and this is one of the autistic children that I've treated. Very similar faces. This is an article that Sally Bernard and her group have written. It's a unique type of mercury poisoning, autism, a unique type of mercury poisoning, for medical hypotheses in 2001. This is a wonderful review paper, and it talks about the symptoms that we see in mercury toxicity, and it compares it to the symptoms that we see in autism. It's a lengthy article, but it's well worth reading. In that paper, she discussed mercury poisoning and said that it affects more males than females. And of course, in autism, we have a male to female ratio of 4-1. At low doses, it affects only the most susceptible, and there's a high concordance rate for monozygotic twins with autism. The symptoms emerge gradually, starting with movement and sensation with mercury, and symptoms emerge gradually from 4 months to 2 years of age. Early abnormalities in movement are noted with autism. In both autism and mercury toxicity, we see psychiatric disturbances, speech, language, hearing problems, sensory abnormalities, cognitive impairments, unusual behaviors, visual impairments, and physical disturbances. And these children, although each is very different, they're all very similar in the way they present. The gastrointestinal disturbances, and a lot of the children have enterocolitis. They're in constant pain, abdominal pain. They'll come into the office and lie across the arm of a chair. And I have a sofa in the room where I see the families. And the children will come in and not sit or lie on the sofa. They'll lie across the back of the sofa so that they get some boosting effect with the abdominal muscles. They have abnormal biochemistry, abnormal immune function, central nervous system structural pathology. There are abnormalities in neurochemistry, EEG abnormalities, there's epilepsy in both mercury toxicity and autism, and the population characteristics are similar. We also see some biological abnormalities in both. Sulfur and sulfate metabolism is involved. We see renal sulfate wasting and intestinal sulfate malabsorption. We see a depletion of tyrosine, glutathione depletion in both, reduction in glutathione peroxidase, and errors in purine and pyrimidine metabolism. We see some problems in the mitochondria, elevated lactic acid, carnitine deficiency, and interference with oxidative phosphorylation. We see a lot of autoimmunity, particularly with the children, but I do see it with my adult patients. And if we test various anti-brain antibodies, myelin basic protein antibody is one in particular, we'll find that a lot of the children are positive. And many of my adult patients, particularly my chronic fatiguers, seem to have those. We see IgE-mediated allergies, and we see decreased cell-mediated immunity and a reduced natural killer cell number and function. Mercury targets selected brain areas, the amygdala, the hippocampus, the brainstem, the Purkinje, and granular cells. We see oxidative damage, and we see neuronal migration in those areas. We see serotonin release and transport, altered dopamine metabolism. We see elevated neurotransmitters, epinephrine and norepinephrine. We see elevated glutamate, cortical acetylcholine deficiency, and demyelination. And so far as the clinical findings are concerned, we see social deficit, social withdrawal. And this is one of the first signs sometimes that the patients will come in with or the parents come in with in the history of the children, is that the child is no longer playing with siblings or has withdrawn to a corner. We see mood swings, flat affect sometimes, anxiety, impaired face recognition, and lack of eye contact. They don't like to be touched. They have touch avoidance, involuntary repetitive movements. They have a lot of flapping, apraxia, difficulty chewing and swallowing, and toe walking. And there's some that will become almost completely normal except for the toe walking. There's a loss or delayed speech development, and in many of the children, we see that they're fine in the first year of life, and following some vaccine series in between 2 and 3 years of age, or 1 and 2 years of age, they will lose speech and lose eye contact almost within a week sometime. They have dysarthria, speech comprehension deficits, and sound sensitivity. Even to the sound and the pitch of my voice, they'll cover their ears. It's apparently very loud to them, very irritating. The placement of the tongue in these children, and he's found through other studies that if they do a pulse oximeter reading on the child, on many of these children, they find that their oxygenation is somewhere in the 70 range, 70 to 75 as opposed to 95. If they reposition the tongue and get a more normal placement of the tongue, they go up to 90 to 95, and the whole child's behavioral pattern changes. So he's interested in doing that, but he had to work with the child to try to do the dental, what do they call them? Impressions, so that they could make the little apparatus to go into the mouth. He said it took him 7 hours on the first child just to get the impression done. So he said, I don't know how many of these children I'll be able to see in a day's time. They have sleep difficulties. We've had children beating their heads literally on the wall 6 and 7 hours at a time at night. I had one family that had to lock the child in a room with nothing but a bed with a see-through window so that they could get some sleep. And the child would sleep 15 minutes and get up for 2 hours, sleep 15 minutes, get up for 2 hours. And this went on all night long. But they are a whole lot better as you retrieve the metal. The eating disorders, some of them eat one food, and it's French fry. There's some parents who are trying to get supplements into the children, and they're actually sandwiching the supplements into the middle of the French fry to get them in. But the feeding problems do improve quite a bit as we get zinc increased and get the metal out. And there are a lot of self-injurious behaviors. They'll chew their hands sometimes until they're blistered on the hands. We see a lot of hypotonia. I'll have children that cannot, at 2 years of age, lift their head up off of a mat on the floor. And after the metal is retrieved and the nutrients are restored, they're crawling around the room and beginning to walk. We see abnormal reflexes, rashes, eczema, excessive sweating, elevated heart rate, dilated pupils. It's very common to see chronic diarrhea or constipation. And some of the children, a lot of them are impacted and dribble diarrhea around the impaction, so it's hard to decide if we're looking at a child who has an impaction versus one who just has a colitis and some diarrhea. And they have anorexia quite often. They don't, when we take them off certain foods, I know we'll have other physicians that say, when the child is hungry, he'll eat, don't worry about taking him off certain foods. These children don't eat. You know, they don't come back and realize that they're hungry, and they don't come in to eat. So you have to be very careful in taking foods out of their diet. There's increased gut permeability and inhibition of DPP-4, which is an enzyme that breaks down a critical bond in a peptide molecule that we're seeing. And we're seeing these children take casein and gluten and combine it with a morphine circulating in the body and get casomorphin and gliadomorphin. And this circulates and builds in the body, and they get the effect of morphine in terms of mood and concentration. In many of the children, when we put them on a casein-free, gluten-free diet, which is one of our first steps, we'll have speech in a child that has not had speech in years. I had a 43-year-old man that had no speech for 35 years that had speech 5 days after changing to a gluten-free, casein-free diet. And the lesions in the ileum and colon. You see abnormal EEGs, clinical seizures, and subtle, very low amplitude seizure activity, which is very hard to pick up. So if we look at the safe levels, we see
for organic mercury, the EPA safe was 0.1 micrograms per kilo per day. The ATSDR is 0.3. The FDA was actually 0.4. It's now 0.1. They've reduced it down to EPA level. And World Health Organization is 3.3 micrograms per kilo per week. If you take a typical 5-kilogram infant and look at all of the supposedly safe levels for organic mercury, and look at the amount of ethyl mercury that we gave in a DTAP, a Hib, and a Hep B given on the same day, it equals 62.5 micrograms. This exceeded all of the safe levels added together. It wasn't just that it exceeded EPA level. If you go back and realize that thimerosal was in vaccines prior to 1930, actually around 1929, all of us probably had thimerosal in vaccines if we had vaccines. But those of us who came through the 50s had only about 50 micrograms. Our children in the 70s had 75 micrograms, and their children in the 90s had 187.5 micrograms. Nobody really sat down and put a pen to paper to realize that if we give three vaccines on the same day, with each containing a level of toxic ethyl mercury that we're going to reach disastrous levels for any given day. So at 2 months and 6 months, we gave 62.5 micrograms to most children. And at 4 months, we gave 50. So we gave 120 times safe, possibly, 100 times, and then 120 times safe at the 6 month. The child probably tried to detox all of this, but we far exceeded the possibilities for some of these children based on their biochemical needs and sources of nutrients. Just the liver detoxification systems were overwhelmed with this amount of metal. If you add aluminum to that and then all of the other toxic substances that we have in vaccines with the metals, you'll realize that the child could not handle that. It's a wonder that we really don't have more than we have. We also looked at the prenatal sources of mercury and the diet of the mother. In our area particularly, there's a lot of seafood being eaten. And Tulane is actively doing some studies on the fish coming out of the Gulf, and it's a sad story. Dental amalgam mercury was spoken of. Rogam, I think, is a huge problem and has been a huge problem. Now, in the PDR in 2002, it doesn't show thimerosal in Rogam. But prior to that, and I'm sure still on the shelf because there was no recall done, you're going to have Rogam with thimerosal. You can, depending on the dose given to the woman, they can get up to 4 times the amount in one vaccine. And this is at the 28th week of gestation. This is during the neural development of the child. We have some of the mothers, depending on what happens during the pregnancy, who will get up to 4 doses of Rogam through the pregnancy. If they spot, they get Rogam. If they do amniocentesis, they get Rogam. So I think this is every bit as important as those vaccines, if not more so. Influenza vaccine. Let's recommend that everyone over 6 months of age and pregnant women from the beginning of gestation, and not just 12 weeks as it used to be, get the flu vaccine that has thimerosal in it. That makes no sense to me at all in the midst of this controversy that we have going on now. But of course, Boyd says now we've decided that thimerosal is not an issue and we should not study that. That's absurd. But flu vaccine needs to be thimerosal-free. Dave Weldon, who is the congressman from Florida, has a bill before Congress to take the mercury, ethyl mercury level down in the vaccines to 1 microgram by January 1st, 2005, and particularly looking at the flu vaccine, but that won't help them this fall. And who is it that we run to first to give the flu vaccine? The children who are ill and compromised. Now, this was in that study that Boyd talked about that he and Amy Holmes and Mark Blaxall did. And if you look at just the amount, the number of amalgams in the moms of autistic children versus the number of amalgams in the moms of control children, you'll see that there's a significant difference. And look at these are the Rogam-taking moms in the autistic mom generation, and these are the control moms. So most of the mothers in our practice, more than 50% actually, are Rh negative and have had Rogam. Most of the moms of autistic children. If you look at the other ingredients, of course, we've got the aluminum and ethyl mercury, and if you put that in on the same day with other vaccines, you'll get formaldehyde, MSG, phenoxyethanol, polysorbate 20 and 80, sucrose, gelatin, egg, chicken serum, cow serum, monkey kidney, sheep cells, antibiotics, human tissue, and this is not even a full list. Now, who among us would take an injection with all of these things in it on any given day? Yet, so many people bring the children in and don't have any idea because they never see this list, and the physician never sees this list.